We're going to begin with a verse from an Old Testament book, and it simply reads, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and he feared God, and he shunned evil." Of course, we're talking about the man Job, and when you talk about Job, there are scholars who believe that that's just a book of poetry. It's a book of hyperbole, and it doesn't really mean that this man suffered all those things that he went through. And certainly, if there is divine commentary about people in the Old Testament, what that does is that supports the fact that they existed. For instance, when Jesus was talking about raising up his body, he says, "Like Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days, so will the Son of Man be in the belly of the earth." What Jesus was doing was saying that was a true story. James talks about the person Job, and he talks about the fact that we have heard of the perseverance of Job. And what he's doing is he's endorsing the story of Job as a true story. So with that being the basis of our discussion this morning, we want to begin with a reading, and we're going to read several verses together. Now, this is not a new story, I don't think, to most of you, but we want to read together, beginning in verse 6 of chapter 1 of the book of Job. "And there was a certain day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them." And I might just say that that's a situation where scholars have a lot of disagreement about what that actually means, but it seems to me the best understanding that I can come to is that God, on occasion, will call together those of his created spiritual beings, angels and the like. And if we recall, the beginning of Satan was the fact that he was from heaven. Jesus refers to the fact that he saw Satan cast out of heaven like lightning. Isaiah chapter, I believe it's chapter 14, talks about the fact that he is identified as one who wanted to overthrow God, who wanted to be like God, and so God cast him down. So this among these people that are gathered together before God to give an account, it's not a judgment, it's just an accounting. They present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth. He is blameless and upright. He is one who fears God and he shuns evil." So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him and around all of his household and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." So the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person." And Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now, when there was day, a day that his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine with their oldest brother, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were feeding beside them. And when the Sabaeans raided them, they took them away. And indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you." When he was still speaking, another came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three bands. They raided the camels. They took them away. Yes, they killed the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house. And it fell on the young men, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you." So you think you've had a bad day.
I believe this is a true story. I don't believe that this is hyperbole. I believe that God has given Satan the authority and the power to do the things that he has just done. And what he has done is he has rocked Job's world. He has turned his life upside down, and he is shaking him to get everything else he can out of him. We all suffer in this life. Some of you are probably suffering some things that I have nothing to compare to. But we all suffer in this life. And we have to understand the reason for that suffering. It's not because I did something. Certainly, there are things that I can do in my life that have consequences. But the reality is that we live in a dark, fallen, and broken world. It's the result of sin. If you think about the very beginning, what God designed was that he wanted to dwell with mankind. And so he created Adam and Eve, and he placed them in the garden, and they had a perfect relationship with God, and they had everything that they needed. Every need in life was taken care of by God. Until what happened? Until sin came along. And from that moment, six of the saddest words in the Bible was that, and he drove the man out. God took man, and he put him out of paradise. And so what have we been doing ever since then? We've been trying to get back to paradise. We've been trying to find the perfect place. And of course, man, when it's up to us to find it, we search for it in all the wrong places. You know, you open up a magazine, a travel magazine, and it's trying to get you to go to some island out in the Pacific, and there's the pictures of the white sand and the palm trees and all of that, and you say, they advertise it as paradise. But they don't tell you about the mosquitoes. And they don't tell you that it's going to cost you $8,000 to get there. And they don't tell you all of those things, that there's no electricity there. And so, but that's paradise. See, we're looking for that because we want that. And in fact, we want to live forever. That was God's design, that he was going to live with man forever. But when man sinned, God said, you know what, I'm going to put in order a plan so that I can redeem man. Because this is what I want more than anything else, God says. I want to dwell with man. And so he put into place this providential plan that would lead us to eternal life with him. That's what he wants. You know, people talk about, you know, God demands this and God demands that. He wants us to do these things because he wants us to be with him forever. That's how he designed it. So Job has had a rough day. And I just want to ask you, what do you do when you have a rough day? You come home and, you know, you kick the dog. You know, you beat the kids. You yell at your wife. You know, you do... What do you do when you have a rough day? Well, this is what Job did. Job arose, he tore his robe, he shaved his head, he fell to the ground, and he worshiped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. There the Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And in all of this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. I have to tell you, I'm not there yet. I don't know that I could do what Job did if this happened in my life. I'd like to think that I could. I'd like to think, well, I'm a Christian and I rely on God for everything and I get all of my strength from him. But I'm just telling you, if this happened to me, I'm not sure that I'm there yet. But Job was. And in all of this, he didn't sin with his lips. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? And Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. The Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil, and still... he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited him against me to destroy him without cause. So Satan answered and said, skin for skin, yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. And so the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life. And Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of ashes. And his wife said to him, do you still hold your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? And in all of this, Job did not sin with his lips. I want us to think about what happened on this occasion, on these two occasions. These created beings were assembling before God, and they were giving an account. They were reckoning themselves to their Creator. And Satan was among them, and God says to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? Now, he was bringing some attention to Job's life with Satan. And Satan says, well, of course I have. And the reason that he is so indebted to you, and the reason that he is submitting himself to you, is because you've built this little wall around him, and I can't penetrate it. If you allow me to get to him, I can change that equation. And so he says, go ahead. That was the first time. And so he loses all of his earthly possessions, all of his wealth. He was the most wealthiest man in the East, the scripture said. He takes away all of his wealth, and he takes away his family, his seven sons and his three daughters. I can't imagine losing one child. He loses all of his children. We would say he's lost everything. But what did he have? What did he have that was of more value? Now think about this. It was more value than all of his possessions, and it was more value than his family. It was his relationship with God. And what that says to us is that there is a hierarchy in our life that we need to follow. And that hierarchy is that God is at the very top of our life. Jesus is referred to as being preeminent in our life. That means first place. And so there are people who will not come to God. They will not submit themselves to God because their family won't like it. And the reality is that God says, I have to have first place. You can't put your possessions before me. You can't put your family before me. I have to have first place. Well, we see what happens. That it didn't get to him. He was in mourning, certainly. He was sad that he lost all of those things, but he said, you know what? The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. So the second time now, God calls together these created beings and they are giving an account, and he says to Satan, it didn't work. You thought you knew Job, and you really don't know Job. He's a unique individual. He is a man who really has dedicated his life to me. And he says, you know what? If I was allowed to touch him physically, I mean, it's one thing to lose your possessions. It's one thing to lose your family, because even though that's a part of you, it's not you. But you touch his flesh, and you'll see what happens. You'll see the real Job kind of bubble up to the surface. And he says, go ahead, but don't take his life. Now, I've never had a boil before. I've known some people who have, and they are very painful, I understand. And that's if you have one or two. But he's got them from the bottom of his feet to the top of his head. And he's been reduced now to taking a potsherd. That's not something that we really think about and know what that is. It's a broken piece of pottery. And he is scraping the sores on his body so that, and I'm not trying to be too gross, but so that the sores can breathe so that they can heal. And he's just a mess. And his wife comes up and says, "What is wrong with you? Why are you putting up with all of this? The best thing for you to do is just to check out. Curse God and die." And he says, "That's foolish talk. That is absolutely foolish talk. I'm not going to listen to that." So Job shows his integrity. Now, the rest of the book of Job is a series of conversations that he has with his friends. And his friends come to see him, and they see him from afar off, and they are reduced to tears when they see their friend because they can't believe what's happened to him. And they sit together in silence for 7 days. And I think there's something to be said there. This is kind of just a side note. But you know, when you go to see somebody that's been devastated, you know, I think we all have this in common. You know, you're on your way to see them. You say, "What am I going to say to them? I have no idea what to say. I can't relate to what's happening in their life." Next time that happens to you, go to see somebody. Just sit down and hold their hand and just sit quietly. Put your arm around them and just sit quietly. Because I think what you're going to find is that people are going to say, "You know, that was more meaningful to me than you saying something that didn't make any sense." But his friends come to see him, and so they begin to have this exchange. And the end of the story is the fact that he maintains his integrity. And of course, at the end of the story, he is given twice as much as he had before. So there is this image of Job that he is really a shadow of the Christ. Because he started out with everything. He was reduced to nothing. And then he finished in glory again. And if you think about the life of Christ, that's exactly how it was. He was in glory with God. He put on flesh, and he wasn't just obedient as a son, but he was obedient to the point of death. He went to the very bottom, and then he raised to glory again. That's the theme of 1 Peter, this idea that it's suffering that leads to glory. And so Job is a great shadow of the Christ. But I'm interested this morning in this question that God asks Satan. Because he says to him, "Have you considered my servant Job? Do you think it's possible that God continues to call together those created beings?" And he continues to ask that question about other people. You think it's possible that he asked him about his son? "Have you considered my son, Jesus," Satan? And he said, "Well, yes, I have. I know who he is. Because when you cast the man and the woman, Adam and Eve, out of paradise, you placed a curse on me. And the curse was that the seed of this woman is going to crush your head." He said, "You're going to bruise his heel, but he's going to crush your head." And so I took that as a challenge. And so what I've been doing ever since then is I've been trying to destroy the seed of woman, your son, Jesus Christ. And he tried it in a number of ways. You just go back through the Bible and you look at times when the Israelites were, different rulers tried to annihilate them. That was Satan trying to destroy the seed of woman. All through time, there were these times when, even when Jesus was born, you remember Herod was saying, "Kill all the babies." What was happening there? That was Satan trying to destroy the seed of woman. And he failed. And so perhaps he comes to God and says, "Well, of course I've considered your son Jesus, but you've built this hedge around him. You know, I can't get through to him." And so God says then, "Well, have at him. Have at him." Luke chapter 4 talks about the occasion when Jesus was in the wilderness and he was tempted by the devil. And we typically look at that passage and we say, "Well, Jesus was tempted 3 times. And if you were just to read Matthew chapter 4, that's kind of the impression that you get. But Luke kind of gives us a little more detail. And Luke says to us that he was tempted in the wilderness for 40 days. Which gives us a little more weight to what the Hebrew writer says when he says that he was in all points tempted as we are, but the difference was, yet he was without sin. So, on that occasion, Satan was throwing everything that he had at Jesus. Jesus didn't go for it. It's interesting to me, just as a side note, how he was able to defeat Satan. On every occasion, when he said, you know, turn these stones into bread. He said, bow down and worship me. Cast yourself off the pinnacle of the temple. On every occasion, what was Jesus' response? Have you not read? You know, we tend to think sometimes that it's so difficult in life and trying to fight against Satan. And I'm going to tell you, it is difficult, but the answers are in the Scriptures. The answers are in the Scriptures. Have you not read? That's what the answer is. So not only was he able to touch his person, he took it a little bit further than with Job. He took his life. And don't you know that when Jesus was on the cross and when Jesus finally said, it is finished, that Satan was having the party of his life. It was the best day of his existence. Because from his perspective, he had finally bested God. And then 3 days later, it was the worst day. Because he knew at that moment, when Jesus rose from the dead and the tomb was empty, he knew at that point that he would never win. So do you think it's possible that another day comes along and God says to Satan, have you considered my sons and my daughters? And that's us. I sure would like it if God was able to say about me, have you considered David Curry? He's blameless and he's upright. He fears God. And he turns away from evil. Wouldn't that be great if that's what your tombstone said? That would say it all, wouldn't it? So he's after us. I want you to think about why it is he's after us. Think of all the billions of people that have ever lived. The people that have submitted their life to God, to his will. Those are the ones that he's after. He doesn't care about the others because he's already got them. He wants us. We are his targets. I'm a big fan of the Far Side comics. It's just one frame if you're familiar with them. And usually it's animals. And there's one in particular that is my favorite of all time. It's a scene in the woods and there are some deer that are kind of standing behind a tree. And there's another deer standing by himself away from them. And on his side, he's got a big target. And the caption is, that one of the others behind the tree just says, man, that's a bummer of a birthmark. That's how it is with Christians. We've got a target on us. We read in the scripture reading that our adversary, the devil, is roaming about like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. You ever seen a roaring lion? I mean, I watch Nat Geo and Discovery and all that, so I've seen these stories about lions and all of that. I've never encountered a lion. I mean, at the zoo maybe, you know, but, you know, there's a safe distance between us and all of that. My oldest son was... After 9/11, he and his cousin signed up to be in the Marines. And they ended up in Baghdad. And they were in the green zone. I don't know if you remember the green zone, but in Baghdad, there were kind of three layers there in the capital city, and the centermost part was the safest, and then you had another area outside of that was secure, and then you had another area outside of that was a little less secure. And there were these checkpoints to get into the middle. And that was where we were operating. My son was there. And after they took Saddam Hussein, they began to reveal to everybody about the lavish lifestyle and the fact that although he was supposed to be a Muslim, he wasn't really faithful because, you know, his palaces were full of alcohol, and they were full of pornography, and they were full of all kinds of things that a Muslim shouldn't be involved in. And so they began to expose all of this. Well, one day, one of the colonels came into a group that my son was with, and he said, "I'm going to take you on a field trip today." And they went out in the desert to one of the sun's palaces. Uday and Kusay, I think, were their names. Those were probably some of the most evil men that have ever lived. I mean, you talk about evil incarnate. These were men who would walk up to a female on the street, and they would say, "I want to be with you," and she'd say, "Well, I'm engaged, or I have a boyfriend, or I'm married," or whatever it might be. And there are stories where they would actually take the man that was with them, take him upstairs to a tall building, and throw him off onto the sidewalk and say, "Well, he doesn't exist anymore. You're mine now." And they would have their way with him and then just kick him out. These men were evil. Well, so they were looking around their palace and looking at the lavish lifestyles that they were living. And they began to hear some really loud sounds, and they began to question, what were these sounds? And so the colonel took them out into the back of the property, and there was a big pit that was dug in the ground, and there was a wrought iron fence that was around it. And down in that pit were four or five lions. And it wasn't like it was a zoo. It was for torture purposes. And they were such paranoid individuals that if they felt like somebody was doing them wrong, or they looked at them wrong, or they spoke to them wrong, or whatever it might be, they would gather everybody from the palace, and they'd go outside, and they'd stand around this wrought iron fence, and they'd throw this person in there, and they'd make them watch them, tear them apart, and eat them alive. And you know, according to people that know about lions, they roar right before they eat. So now I want you to think about our adversary, the devil, who is walking around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. We have to stop thinking about Satan with, you know, he's all red, he's got these little horns, he's got a cape, he's got a little pitchfork. You know, it's just kind of humorous, really. You know, "Oh, look at Satan." And it's even sadder when we even dress little kids up on Halloween like Satan. Oh, isn't that cute? There's nothing cute about our adversary. What he wants to do is he wants to rip you apart limb by limb, spiritually speaking. Have you considered the rest of my children? You know, when people are baptized into Christ and they come up out of the water, they don't come out with a Teflon coating on them. It'd be great if we did. It'd be great if nothing bad ever stuck to us again. But that's just not the reality. The reality is that, frankly, your life just might get a little more difficult now that you have put Christ on. Peter talks about the fact that the suffering of Christ has become an example for us, that we can follow in his footsteps. I remember as a little boy going to the Gulf beaches in Florida, and we'd be taking a walk, and my dad would get ahead of me, and I would try to jump from one footprint to the next because I wanted to follow the most important thing in my life. And what Peter says, if you think about that image, what Peter says is that Jesus, there's some footprints for us to follow. The life of Christ is something worthy of us following. But when we do that, we have to understand, sometimes we're going to face adversity. We're going to face some really difficult things in our life. But the end result is that it's worth suffering through those things. Because what waits for us is glory. And what waits for us is this opportunity to be with God forever. Do you think that that's fair, that Satan has just such broad access to us? Wouldn't it be great if we could just pray to God and say, would you make him stop? Don't allow him to do this to me anymore, or to my family, or to my friends, or to the church, or to whatever it might be. Peter was an apostle of Jesus Christ. You remember what Jesus said to him? He said, Peter, Satan has asked for you so that he may sift you like wheat. But I pray that when you return, you will strengthen the brethren. We all know about Peter. We all know about the fact that he was the one who denied Christ 3 times. Even though he stood up and said, there's absolutely no way that that's going to happen. And that's when Jesus told him, this is going to happen. You are going to do this. But you're going to return. And I want you to strengthen the brethren when you do. Before Jesus left the apostles, he had an opportunity to sit with Peter. And he gave him 3 occasions. 3 times that he was able to affirm his love for him. And I don't think that's an accident. He denied him 3 times. He affirmed his love again for him 3 times. So how does that make you feel? How does it make you feel to know that Satan is still asking for us? And that he is still being allowed to sift us like wheat? All I have to say to people is if you're not suffering yet, if something really bad has not happened in your life, the reality is probably you haven't lived long enough. Because trust me, talk to somebody who's a little bit older than you, and they can tell you what difficulty is like.
The question is he going to succeed or is he going to fail? One of the most powerful images that I have ever seen was a picture of a man who's leaning at the foot of his son's bed. His son's just a small child, and he's praying. And above the house in the heavens, you see these spiritual beings that are engaged in mortal combat. And then there is a verse that is at the bottom of the picture. And the verse simply says, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but we wrestle against principalities and powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age. We wrestle against Satan and his angels. When we do a Bible study and we learn about who Satan really is, Jesus said he's the father of lies. He was cast down from heaven because he tried to rebel against God. He has the ability to transform himself into an angel of light. He can convince us of something that doesn't really exist. He has a lot of power. We need to recognize the fact that he has that power. And that we are engaged with him every day. Wrestling is fascinating to me. I don't like, professional wrestling, but Olympic-style wrestling and that kind of thing. I had a friend in high school that just tried desperately to get me to be on the wrestling team because I was very small in high school. I mean, I'm not a big guy now, but I was pretty small. And really,
he had ulterior motives because they needed the smallest weight. But I didn't have enough self-esteem to put a singlet on. I didn't really like those little uniforms that they wore. So I said, no, that's not for me. But my boys wrestled in high school. And you know, the great thing about wrestling is you're on a team and you have a team score. But when you get out on the mat, it's you and the other guy. And it's fierce. You are engaged in this battle. And that's the imagery that Paul describes for us, because that's what it is with us in our spiritual life. We are wrestling with the devil. And the way that we wrestle with him is he throws all of these temptations at us. And we have to get to the point where we begin to recognize what they are and what's happening. It's not because all of a sudden, wow, I feel good about this person. Or wow, this drug or this drink or whatever it might be really makes me feel... It's not about that. It's about the fact that the source is Satan. He's the source. And so you hear people say things like, I just wasn't able to overcome that. I mean, after all, I'm flesh and blood. That's a poor excuse. It is true that we are flesh and blood. It is true that we succumb to temptation and that we give in and that we sin. But do you ever think about what Paul said to the Corinthians? He said, no temptation has overcome man that he's not able to overcome himself, to paraphrase. He said, with every temptation, God has provided what? A way of escape. There was a story, it's just a story, but it's pretty good, of a carnival that was coming to town. It was a little small country town, and this carnival was coming, and they were advertising in advance, and they said, you need to come out and you need to see the world's largest gorilla. It's 12 feet tall, 3,000 pounds. They had him in this massive cage. And so everybody's in the building, and they've got the gorilla up in the front of the building, and it's impressive. And people are starting to kind of say things and they kind of poke at him a little bit. And he gets angry, and he starts to bend the bars on the cage. He's going to come out. And there's a couple farmers sitting there with their overalls on. And one of them says, where's the back door to this place? He's looking, right? He's trying to find a way of escape. And the other guy says, there ain't one. And so he looks back at him. He says, well, where do you reckon they want one? You see what's happening there? He's going to find a way to get out. And what Paul says is, God's providing a way to get out. What we have to start doing is we have to start looking for it. Because it's there. God promised it. God can't lie. Well, there is a final question that everybody has to consider. You remember when Jesus was before Pilate? Pilate was trying to figure out what he's going to do. You know, he's finding himself between a rock and a hard place because he knows he's innocent. So he asked a question in Matthew. He says, what do you want me to do with this Jesus who is called Christ? And I submit to you that same question this morning. I submit to you that God is asking every man and woman, and he's saying, what are you going to do with Jesus? Or maybe he's saying it this way. Have you considered my son, Jesus? And have you considered what he can do for you? And what it is that he can do for you is he can make it possible for you to live forever. You know, when you ask that question, who wants to live forever? I mean, unless there's some kind of mental incapacity or unless there's some kind of physical pain that is so difficult that you don't want to, that you can't see yourself continuing, everybody's going to raise their hand. Why do we do that? Because the preacher In Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 11 said, God has placed eternity in our hearts. We can't help it. We want to live forever. And God says, and I want you to live forever, and I want you to live with me. And the only way that that's possible is through the blood of my Son, Jesus Christ. Have you considered Him? Are you willing to believe that He is the Son of God? And based on that belief, are you willing to just do what Jesus asked? It's not that the church here at Courthouse Road is asking you to do it, all they want you to do it. But what Jesus just says, he who believes and is baptized will be saved. Do you believe that? We allow Him to save you today. If you consider Jesus, if you want to do that even today, we want to help you with that. Please let us know while we stand together and sing.